The outlaws sat dispiritedly in the old barn. Eventually, Ginger spoke.
"Here we are, without any money for the football," he said. "And if we've not got it by 8 o'clock tomorrow evening, Bertie Franks will get it. And won't he jolly well crow over us?"
Victor Jameson was selling his football for half a crown, and if William couldn't raise the required cash by 8 o'clock tomorrow, Victor had promised, reluctantly, to sell it to Bertie Franks, one of the Hubert Laneites, and therefore one of the outlaws' oldest enemies.
"The thing is to think of some way of getting that half crown," said Henry. "We've not got much time."
Suddenly, a little girl appeared at the open door of the barn. It was a little girl well known to the outlaws, Violet Elizabeth Bott of the Hall. The outlaws did not generally regard Violet Elizabeth Bott with very tender feelings. She carried feminine variability to extremes, and despite her youth, she was 6 years old, could deal effectively with almost any crisis. She had for this purpose a large armoury of weapons. She could sob in a most realistically heartbroken manner at a moment's notice, and her proudest boast was that she could be sick at will. She stood in the doorway, gazing at the outlaws in silence and sucking a stick of rock. There was a limpid guilelessness in her blue eyes that the outlaws had long ago learned to distrust. She stared at them over her stick of rock and sucked with an air of gentle melancholy.
"We don't want you," said William brusquely. "We're busy. Go away."
Too late, he remembered that this was the one way of making certain that Violet Elizabeth would not leave till she had discovered every detail of the business on which they were engaged.
"What are you busy doing?"
she demanded. "Nothing," said William succinctly.
"You can't be busy doing nothing,"
objected Violet Elizabeth with an air of deep wisdom.
"It isn't possible."
"Yes, it is," said William, mimicking her, in a forlorn hope of annoying her. But Violet Elizabeth took the rock out of her mouth and smiled at William with devastating sweetness.
"You are funny, William."
They all gazed at her helplessly. She handed the stick of rock to William with a gesture of friendliness.
"Have a thuck," she said generously. "Have a big thuck. Bite a piece off if you like."
Rock was one of William's weaknesses. He bit a large piece off, trying to preserve an impassive demeanour, as if he were doing it entirely without prejudice. She handed it to Ginger.
"Bite a piece off, Ginger."
Neither could Ginger resist the bright pink bait. He too bit a large piece off. Henry and Douglas, seeing the fall of their leaders, made no attempt at resistance. Each bit off a large portion, and Violet Elizabeth popped the remaining fragment into her mouth, and for some moments the five of them crunched in silence. Then Violet Elizabeth, swallowing the last remnant, said once more,
"What are you busy doing?"
Their former attitude of aloof severity seemed difficult to maintain. William unbent so far as to give her the information she demanded.
"We're trying to think of a way of making money," he said. "So now you know, and you can jolly well go away, because we don't want you."
"How much money do you want?"
said Violet Elizabeth. "Half a crown."
"How much is half a crown?"
2 shillings and 6pence.
2 shillings and 6pence, repeated Violet Elizabeth, impressed. "That's a lot of money."
And she sat down by William, keeping so still for a few moments that it didn't seem possible to object to her presence. At last she broke the silence.
"My father knows a man that made lots of money by nightclubs."
"What are they?" demanded William suspiciously.
"They're clubs, and people go to them at night and pay lots of money."
"Well, we can't do that, so you may as well shut up about it."
"Why can't we do that, William? It's easy enough to have a nightclub. We can have it here, and everyone will come to it."
"Oh, yes. They'll all likely come to a nightclub when they've all got to be in bed by 8, won't they?"
"We'll shut it up at 8, William. We'll have it from 6 to 8. You can make lots of money by a nightclub."
"Well, what do people do at nightclubs?" said William, weakening.
"They sit at little tables and drink things. They pay money to come in, and then they pay more money to sit at little tables and drink things."
"Well, we haven't got any little tables, and we haven't got anything for them to drink," said William.
"We needn't have tables," she said persuasively. "Not real tables, William. Packing cases will do. They can sit on the floor and packing cases, and we can get liquid water for them to drink. They can pay tuppence and have 3 swallows each. It won't cost you anything, William, and you'll make lots and lots of money."
William hesitated and was lost.
"Well, what else do you want for a nightclub?" he said.
"A cabaret,"
said Violet Elizabeth, whose vocabulary was, in some ways, more extensive than her years. William tried to hide his ignorance of the meaning of this word.
"Oh, we've got one at home," he said. "Several, in fact, but I know my mother wouldn't let me bring one here."
"I mean someone to sing and dance,"
said Violet Elizabeth patiently.
Oh, that. Well, who'll do it?"
"I will," said Violet Elizabeth. "I can sing and dance. I'll put on a Chinese shawl of my mother's and I'll sing and dance in it. And then when I've finished, they can dance if they want. They do in nightclubs."
"Well, it sounds jolly dull. And what else do they do in nightclubs?"
"There must be an orchestra and they must play things to make lots of noise."
And what else?"
"They must sign their names in a book when they come in."
"Anything else?"
Violet Elizabeth considered deeply, then brought out another choice morsel from her store of worldly knowledge.
"There must be a raid."
"A raid?"
"A raid by the police. There's always a raid by the police in a nightclub."
William had the feeling he so often had in his dealings with this redoubtable child, a feeling of being stripped of his authority and ousted from his position as chief, and with a sweetness and apparent pliability that gave him no handle against her.
"We'll charge them tuppence to come in, and tuppence for the liquid water, and I guess we'll make lots and lots more than 2 shillings and 6 pence.
"All right," said William, yielding to the inevitable. "We might as well try it anyway."
Secretly, he was deeply interested in the idea, but wished it had been his own and not Violet Elizabeth's. They spent the next morning preparing the old barn and distributing handbills to the children of the neighbourhood. The handbills were drawn up by Violet Elizabeth herself, printed in red chalk. A space was kept at the end of the barn for the orchestra, who were to be William and Ginger. William with a mouth organ and a tin tray, Ginger with a trumpet and a particularly raucous rattle. In this space, too, Violet Elizabeth was to dance and sing. It had been arranged that Douglas should hand round the drinks while Henry took the money at the door and kept the club register. A certain amount of excitement reigned among the youthful population of the neighbourhood. Long before 6, a vanguard appeared in the form of a handful of children, apparently under the leadership of a lanky girl with red hair, a thin pointed nose, and a suspicious expression. Violet Elizabeth arrived at about 5:50, closing the door with an air of stern officialdom in the nose of the vanguard leader. She wore an expression of suppressed excitement.
"I say," she began, "I say, I've arranged a surprise."
"What sort of surprise?" said William.
"A secret surprise," said Violet Elizabeth. "I thought of it just now. It's a lovely secret surprise. It'll make an absolutely real nightclub."
2 Chinese lanterns had been hung up, and some candle ends had been stuck upon the packing case tables as means of illumination. Douglas was anxiously inspecting the jugs of licorice water they'd concocted. So pale had it looked that he had, on the impulse of the moment, dissolved a cake of black paint from his paint box in each jug. The church clock slowly struck 6, and Henry flung open the door. The red-haired vanguard leader marched in first. Henry asked her to sign her name in the book, which was an old arithmetic exercise book of William's. She refused. He asked her to pay the tuppence entrance. She refused, but offered him instead a halfpenny, which she said was enough to pay for her own entrance and that of the rest of the vanguard whom she was minding. A large crowd was gathering behind her. Helplessly, Henry let the vanguard push its way through. Other patrons then arrived. Following the vanguard's example, they refused either to sign the book or to pay more than a halfpenny. While one was paying a halfpenny, 2 others generally squeezed in without paying anything. Last of all came Bertie Franks. He showed a half-crown ostentatiously to Henry, and he paid his halfpenny with a particularly insulting grin that said, more plainly than words, "Yeah, I've got my half-crown, and you're a jolly long way off yours yet." The barn was now practically full, and Henry counted his takings, 24 halfpennies, 1 shilling. They were still 1 and 6 pence off their goal, but he looked forward hopefully to the other attractions. They might get 1 and 6 pence for the licorice water. The vanguard leader was now making trouble about the seating accommodation. "Disgraceful, I call it, charging a halfpenny for sitting on the ground." William felt that it was time for the entertainment to begin. He and Ginger took their seats on the floor, their instruments around them, and leapt into a riot of discord worthy of the highest tradition of jazz. Violet Elizabeth put on her mother's Chinese shawl and began to sing. She had a shrill little voice, quite in tune, that rose clearly above the blare of the orchestra. She sang London Bridge is Falling Down and Mad About the Boy. Douglas began to hand round the licorice water. At once, the Vanguard leader snatched the jug from Douglas's hand and took a deep draught. No, she informed the others. I wouldn't pay to drink this. What's it made of, ink? Despite Douglas's entreaties, the other patrons passed the jug round, each taking experimental draughts gratis. That was, of course, the end of the nightclub. The first taste of the liquid definitely suggested licorice water, but the aftertaste had a lingering unpleasantness that gradually turned to nausea. On learning that this was to be all the refreshment provided, and that the orchestra and Violet Elizabeth were to be the only entertainment, the patrons rose in a body and demanded the return of their money. In vain, William argued with them. You don't know how to act in a nightclub, he said. That's all they do in a nightclub. They do just sit at tables and drink and listen to music. And dance. You can dance if you like. I tell you, you don't know how to act in a nightclub. But the Vanguard leader apparently did know how to act in a nightclub. She made a sudden raid upon the unsuspecting Henry, plunged her hand into the pocket that contained the entrance money, and triumphantly withdrew her halfpenny. You're nothing more than robbers, she said furiously, as she flounced out, followed by her charges. The other patrons raided Henry, took from him their entrance fees, and surged out of the barn. The last patron to depart was Bertie Franks. As he went, he held up his half-crown with an irritating grin and said, I'm going round for that football now. It's nearly eight. The outlaws turned accusingly upon Violet Elizabeth, the originator of the scheme, but she forestalled them. Why did you let them go? She screamed angrily. I was just going to dance. Haven't you got any sense? She stopped abruptly. A policeman had appeared in the doorway of the barn. Violet Elizabeth stamped her foot at him furiously. Go away, she said. You're too late. Why didn't you come before? We don't want you now. They've all gone. Go away, I tell you. For the policeman was the secret surprise that Violet Elizabeth had prepared for the nightclub. He was to lend the final touch of atmosphere to it. She had sent him a note. Please raid Old Barn between 7 and 8. The policeman was of a credulous disposition. Moreover, there had just been a sensational burglary at Lady Markham's, less than 5 miles away, last night, and the police theory was that the burglar had hidden the bulk of his spoils somewhere in the neighbourhood in order to escape unhampered by them, intending to return later. The policeman had not the faintest doubt that the note was connected with this burglary, an illiterate accomplice squeaking or a spurned sweetheart getting her own back. He flashed his lantern on the children. Clear out, you kids, he said shortly. Violet Elizabeth stared at him, open-mouthed with indignation. He took no notice of her, but began to make a thorough search of the old barn, moving the boxes, inspecting the walls and roof, and finally turning over a pile of filthy, rotten sacks that had stood in a corner ever since the outlaws could remember. What's the sense of raiding it now? Violet Elizabeth demanded scornfully. Now they've all gone home. What's the sense of it? But the policeman had closely examined each sack and had now got down to the bare earth beneath the pile. He knelt down and began to dig with his hands. He drew something out of the hole, another sack newer than the others. He opened it and peeped inside. Gosh, he said faintly, it's the stuff. Immediately all was confusion and uproar. William was dispatched to the police station. Soon a young man, Lady Markham's secretary, arrived on a motorcycle. But who sent the note? He said, when he'd heard all about it.
I sent the note, said Violet Elizabeth proudly. I sent it, because I wanted him to raid the club.
I don't care why you sent it, said the young man. It's deliver the goods, all right. Now, young lady, choose what reward you'd like. If it's anything in reason, I'm sure Lady Markham will give it to you.
I'll think about it, said Violet Elizabeth cautiously. But if his club, she pointed at William, and he wants half a crown.
Smiling, the young man took half a crown out of his pocket and handed it to William. William said, thank you, and then seemed to disappear as completely as if the earth had opened to swallow him up. Just before 8 o'clock, Bertie Franks walked jauntily up the steps of Victor Jameson's house and knocked at the door. Victor Jameson opened it himself.
I've come for the football, said Bertie with a grin.
William's not got the half crown.
Victor's face displayed no great enthusiasm at this news.
You promised it me, you know, Bertie reminded him. If William hadn't got the half-crown by 8 o'clock, and he hasn't, and it's 8 now.
All right, said Victor, I'll go and get it. He disappeared into the house.
The church clock began to strike 8. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. At the 7th stroke, Victor appeared with the football. At the 7th stroke, something else happened. A human tornado swept up the drive from the gate, snatched the football from Victor's hands, and thrust a half-crown into them instead. The 8th stroke struck.
William sank upon the top step, clasping his football closely to him. "Crumbs," he panted. "Only just in time.